So this is, there's a few things I want to say as we begin this class about this text called Eight Aspects of Buddhism by Hakun Yasutani. The first thing I want to say is that we have to remember that, as he describes in the introduction, this is really his way of setting forth what his teacher, Dayun Harada Roshi, used to teach as the eight important points. So Harada Roshi was someone born in the 19th century who lived into, you know, part of the first half of the 20th century. So we've got a point of view that expresses itself in 19th and 20th century ways of expressing things. And then Yasutani Roshi also was born in the 19th century and lived into a little more than the first half of the 20th century. So we've got something that is expressing itself in a way that's somewhat dated for us, and that the translation of this into English, it occurred in 1966, 1967, 1968. I think some of you have a copy of my copy of it, which was, I copied in the early 1970s. So sometimes the language in English is a little archaic for us in the 21st century, and also sometimes some points are made in a way that was appropriate then because, what should I say, just starting to write about Buddhism in English, and therefore now might be better said in different ways. But we'll just work with that. So what I want to do is go through this almost paragraph by paragraph, because I think this is very valuable, but at the same time, we need to chew on it and make sense of it, and sometimes restate it in order for us to really appreciate what it is he's saying. And in a way, Yasutani Roshi makes a point in the very beginning where he says, in the first paragraph, he says, even though he talks about it as if it's eight different points, it's really only one, or we could say one whole, that's seen at, from different angles and different facets. And when we emphasize one facet, it might be that the other angles are seem hidden or seem dark, but they're not. And if we emphasize one aspect and we think that aspect is more important than the others, we're not quite getting it. And if you think they it excludes some of the others, then we're not quite getting it. And yet, we have to clarify each facet, and sometimes we use language that puts more emphasis and sort of leaves out the dark parts, the dark meaning the missing parts on the other side, but they're not really being left out, but we unfortunately have to use a language that tends to be dualistic and either or and so on and so forth. So, nevertheless, what's important for us is to clarify the particular aspect that we're attempting to clarify, because what we're talking about is clarifying what our life is. Even though we start off with this first chapter called Buddha Nature, it's really our nature that we're talking about. And if we use the word Buddha nature, it's fine, but it's also, we sometimes want to reify that and think there's something called Buddha nature, which is what he's going to start off right away. He starts off talking about all beings are Buddha nature. Or he starts with all beings have Buddha nature. And you should have your text in front of you and be looking at this. It's page 8 in the text that you have online. And he makes the point. All beings or all sentient beings is all beings, everything you encounter, human beings, animals, plants, inanimate objects, etc., etc. All things that you can't even grasp as beings, and yet, so he says, Buddha nature is a name for all existence. And existence is also all non-existence, because as soon as we use the word existence, we think we know, okay, it means this, but not that. And so that's where I want to start, and I want to see what the next two paragraphs are. Pretty straightforward, except you might not quite get it. So what I want to do is I want to encourage you to say, do you get these first four paragraphs where, you know, on that first page where he talks about the sixth ancestor, and then he talks about Dogen's way of, in a way, emphasizing even more all beings or all sentient beings are Buddha nature itself and nothing else, meaning so even is and is not is irrelevant to it, but we tend to want to say is, exists, or is not. So what is it? Tell me how you understand that and what you might feel is not quite clear about that.
I think in the third paragraph, where he says the sixth when the sixth patriarch met the fifth patriarch for the first time, the fifth patriarch asked if it were true that the people living south of the mountain lacked good nature. The sixth patriarch replied that even though there's a north and south, as far as the Buddha nature is concerned, there's neither north nor south. Because of this answer, he was able to become the student of the fifth patriarch. So the thing about that that I see is, you know, of course they all have Buddha nature. That's one thing. But couldn't it have been said that where he says, as far as Buddha nature is concerned, there is neither north nor south, couldn't there be north and south?
No, no.
Yeah.
See, first you have to get that what he's talking about is in China. And in China, the people in the north were the more cultured ones who looked on the southerners as barbarians. They were not literate, not cultured. They didn't do all the things that cultured Chinese, which at that point was one of the highest civilizations in the world, did. So they considered southerners barbarians. The sixth ancestor himself is supposedly or depicted as an illiterate. So he was a poor woodcutter who was illiterate. So the point is, there is neither north nor south. There isn't a more cultured or less cultured. As far as Buddha nature is concerned, there isn't anything that has more Buddha nature or less Buddha nature. There isn't in Buddha nature. And there is in Buddha nature. We'll get to that as well. But, and that's what he says the very next paragraph. All beings are Buddha nature itself and nothing else. Hence, it's not a matter is or isn't. And it's not a matter north and south, because that still makes it into a thingness. And even the idea of north and south having it is adding something to it. Because then it makes you think, oh, well, everyone here in the north and the south has this thing. The problem is that then we think that there's this thing that sentient beings have called Buddha nature. And that's what he's going to further clarify. We have a tendency to when we use a word, we think we're describing a thing. And in a way, the word Buddha nature is, in one sense, to help us to de-thing ourselves, if I make up a word. Not to be caught in things or in is or in is not. So, see, all existences are Buddha nature. But what does that mean? If we don't live all existences are Buddha nature, then it becomes just words we use. Then we think Buddha nature is some sort of thing. So then he goes into the next thing. Some people think Buddha nature is a spiritual soul of some sort. And it's not that. But let's see if anyone else has something on this first page before I go on. As I said, I want to go paragraph by paragraph because there's important points he's making in each of them, and in a sense they're concentrated and compact, but important points. So,
I have a question about sentient beings.
Yes.
Now, he's saying this for the sake of sentient beings. Is that what I'm thinking?
Sentient beings is, remember, just an English translation. But he's saying this because we tend to, prioritize and give, we tend to privilege sentient beings over and against so-called non-sentient beings. And so he's making clear, even though it says all sentient beings, what it's talking about is all beings. And he says animals, plants, and inanimate objects. In fact, there's, I don't remember when I talked about, there's a famous Chinese case about a teacher asking, a student asking his teacher, do you hear, understand the speech of non-sentient beings? So, but it starts off, all sentient beings have our Buddha nature. And then we have to expand our mind and our ideas because we tend to privilege ourself as a sentient being and whoever else we include in sentient beings. And that's exactly our problem because we believe those stories. The whole universe is just sentient beings, if you want to say it that way. Or the whole universe is just Buddha nature. But what does that mean? So the first thing he wants to make clear is that it's not something called a soul that exists somewhere other than right here. It's not some hidden soul. Or it's not something hidden. Even though we might say that sometimes to help us, but we get in trouble with that. Anyone else? You have to speak up if you want to say something. Since I can't see you, I can't know what's not clear. So the next thing that Yasutani brings up is a story about the earthworm and asking which half contains Buddha nature. Moving, being alive, fine, is Buddha nature. Being dead, fine, Buddha nature. See, does the dog have Buddha nature? Joshu's asked, and he's using the Japanese pronunciation of names for these people that he's citing. So all of these are, in this case, they're Chinese sources, and if you were pronouncing the names in Chinese, it would be a little different. But I don't want to go through that now. And as I said, this represents something coming from the first half of the 20th century for people who would refer to Chinese in the Japanese way of pronouncing those same characters. So, Sir Joshua's asked, does the dog have Buddha nature? Sometimes he says yes, sometimes he says no. And he says, what's the point here? To make us realize Buddha nature is beyond yes and no. So I ask you, in a sense, what is being beyond yes and no? See, that's the point. So, here we could explain it, but to work on this in your practice is really to struggle with what is being right this moment beyond yes and no. And yet, sometimes it's yes, beyond yes and no, and sometimes it's no, beyond yes and no. So, in a way, saying the whole universe is Buddha nature is fine, but if you get stuck in that sort of things, then you've turned Buddha nature into a thing, and things have non-things, and then there's yes and no, and we get in trouble there. So he's going to try to clarify this further. To speak of Buddha nature, in one sense, is to explain the multitudinous things in the universe. But we have to be clear on what is this. So he next tries to help clarify and talk about ku, or emptiness, or non-thingness, or he uses the expression, no fixed entity, or we could say ongoing changingness. So what is this ongoing changingness, which he says is ku, is essence of all existence. So what does that mean? So now he links us to what's to Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is a famous Buddhist ancestor in India who said a number of things. All dharmas or phenomena are a result of cause. I call them ku. This is on page 9 towards the bottom. Now, in a way we could say, I've talked about this before. Really, this is an expression of a saying attributed to Buddha having to do with ongoing changing and impermanence, where it's simplified into the phrase, where there is that, there is this. Where there is not that, there is not this. So, what is that? I'll stop for a moment and see what you want to bring up on up till this point or about this. I know this is not simple, and I'm going fast. So, what do you want to? What is not clear, or what is clear, or how do you understand this?
Well, thank you. This is Debbie. So, and I'm going to have to speak in concepts, or I can't talk about it. But so, non-thingness, which is ongoing, changing,
I wouldn't use the word non-thingness. I would say the selflessness or the self-naturelessness or the non-fixedness.
Okay. So, if it's this, I'm going to use some concepts. It's this.
Yeah.
Continuum of the one, but then he introduces the concept which, you know, talked about a lot in Buddhism as cause and effect.
Yes.
So you're in this state, and not in, but there is this oneness, this, and then there's a cause, and it has an effect. So there's a thing that happens.
No, there's happening. What?
There's
once we say thing that happens, we tend to want to separate the thing from the universe within which it happens and within which it's connected.
But how are you going to talk about this? So,
no, you could say thing as long as you remember that thing includes all the other things that are not included in the word thing, but are included in the word thing.
Sometimes the only way for me to even try to think about this in what I have to think about it, you know, when my perceptions is books we've read before where there's, and it seems kind of dualistic, but there's oneness on this side, but on the other side there's, you know, walking down the street, hitting your foot, and hurt. There's cause and effect, and I don't know how causes rise out of the oneness, and I don't. And then I struggle with. So what was the first cause? You know,
there is no first cause.
Well, then, how does it work?
We don't know how it works because. We know things work, but we know how it works is beyond our limited capacity. For instance, if we want to go to, let's go to quantum physics. So you won't think of it as Buddhism. Each thing in quantum physics has its own time and its own beingness, and it's different from the time and beingness of every other thing. And yet it's also interacting in the being timeness of all the other things. So when we look inside a dark box, what appears is a result of us looking inside the dark box. And if we didn't look, then that what's inside the dark box both is and isn't what appeared.
What do you mean, looking inside the dark box?
Well, Tiger's Cat, you know, the yellow.
I don't know some of your references.
There's a famous quantum physics problem called Schrodinger's Cat.
Yeah.
And there's a dark box, and Schrodinger's Cat has to do with the functions of electrons and other atomic, subatomic particles, and whether a cat is or doesn't exist, there is no existence nor non-existence until one opens the box and looks in to find whether the cat is or isn't there. And the opening the box, looking in, is part of what creates the cat being there or not being there. Or the, let's put it this differently, the atom or the particle being there or not being there, it's not there until we solidify it by the action of looking for it.
Actually, it's both there and not there.
Well, now we're switching into physics as opposed into Buddhism, but yes, the possibilities of it there and not there are both there, even though it doesn't make sense to us when we use the words like that, and we don't think that the universe operates in that way, and yet it does.
Well, it's you know, this is the difficulty we run into when we have to use words, and we do have to use words to try and grasp the experiential aspect of what this teaching is. It's like saying, you know, the universe is space-time, and it had a beginning. So what time did the universe begin? What time was it before the universe began? We can create these questions out of words, but that have no actual meaning in reality. It's just putting concepts together in a string, thinking there's some factoid there that we can grasp, when it always comes down to our experience is cause and effect. Our experience always is change. Our experience always is this moment experience and nothing more.
Well, okay, so change, that seems true to me, even in This experience.
Well, if you don't think it's true, wait, it'll change.
No, constant change is, to me, true. Cause and effect. What are we saying?
That is. Cause and effect is just another way of saying ongoing change.
In other words, Debbie contains Debbie's parent, mother and father, and the cause and effect of Debbie's mother and father coming together as Debbie in this moment. But let's look at the very next paragraph, because he tries to clarify this a little more. So in a sense, cause and effect is Debbie at this moment, which includes Debbie's father and mother at this moment as Debbie, and all sorts of other so-called causes. But let's look. He starts talking about Creator just to get to this causation.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about Creator.
What? Do you see that? This is the last paragraph on page 9. He says, Buddhism teach, and again, of course, even when we use the word Buddhism, we think we're talking about a thing, but we use the word, but please be aware that the word isn't a thing. It's just something that we're using to refer to it. So Buddhism teaches all phenomena, and phenomena includes mental and physical and every other way we can talk about anything. So the universe has phenomena that we know of and phenomena that are dark and mysterious, and nevertheless, they're the result of causation. If causes changes, then there's changes in the effect. And the changes occur in a realm where we don't know. Some we might know of, so I know if I let go of this bottle and it falls, my letting go is one of the causes, but I don't know the many causes that function to make possible letting go and make possible my hand holding and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know the many causes that make possible gravity. And who knows when at some point gravity will cease. We know there are places gravity reverses and ceases and changes, that we call them dark holes or dark stars, et cetera. But in those cases, if I let go of something, it would go the opposite direction. But, so what he's saying, therefore, this is an important, there is, therefore, no phenomena has a fixed entity of its own. No phenomena, and phenomena, again, is mental and physical, has a fixed, and I would add it on, a fixed, continuous. Fixed means ongoing, separate means unchanging, means always so, or means permanent. And also fixed means non-separate when we say no fixed. So, and then he uses some simple examples. If you say, he says, when you say a good person, doesn't have any called specific entity called good, and he or she may become a bad person according to circumstances. And a bad person has no fixed so-called bad, even though we believe, oh, that person is a bad person. Pick the worst person that you could think. I mean, Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, call them all bad. But they all are also, can be good, called good and as well. He says if causes changes, he may become or act like, I'll say, a good person. And he goes on to talk about all sorts of others. I mean, a simple thing is to say, well, Hitler might have been good towards his dog, if he had a dog, or towards animals. I mean, my understanding is Hitler was a vegetarian because he didn't want to harm animals. So, what is that? He expands this to say it can be said of poor people, rich people, healthy, sick, crude, civilized, happy, unhappy, and so on and so forth.
But Elihu, what about, I just don't know if my own experience would tell me that's always true, that there's no fixed, if you just talk about, get real concrete about genetics, aren't there examples of fixed genetic and, scheme, and this physical entity comes out of it, and no matter what the circumstances were, there were bad things that came from this physical person no matter what?
Well, let's start with fixed genetic, because genetic isn't fixed until there's the cause and effect of the two sets of parents, or sperm and egg, if we want to be more, that comes together as a person, and then that goes through a gestation. So it's only the cause and effect that gestation worked, that implantation of the egg, etc., led to a being born. And even then, there's what's called epigenetics, that some things are expressed and some things aren't expressed, even with the genetic predispositions. So,
and mutations too.
What?
And mutations.
Yeah, all sorts of things.
And curves, the genetic code.
So, but the point is, you could say right now, this person here has done something bad. This person here right in front of me. But this person here is the result of all sorts of cause and effects that I can see, and most that I can't see, that come together, including even the food he was given and how he was brought up, or what she did or she didn't do or ingested. So it doesn't say that things don't have the now momentness, but what the point he's trying to make is that the now momentness is the coming together of all sorts of forces.
And I understand that, but I do. I just, and this is just a deviation for me, because it's just something that I kind of think about a lot, is that there, I'm kind of fascinated sometimes by what makes people do evil things and hurt other people. Well, good things, yeah, I guess, but more evil things. And sometimes you can read the life of a being, and it would appear on the surface as if, there was nothing in terms of causes that could ever have explained
Right, but part of it is also when we read the life, we're already picking and choosing a little piece of a 24-hour day, day after day. So we can't see all of it. We can't see very much of it. But one second. If we go to page 10, on the top of the page, the first full paragraph, he says something. The main point is that nothing, that means no person, no thing, has a fixed entity of its own. In other words, everything is connected to all sorts of other everythings. I mean, for instance, even on the simple level, we're connected to the fact that there's air and sunshine and food today, September 20th. If there was no air here where I'm living right now, I couldn't be speaking to you. So there's all sorts of cause and effect that make it possible for the sunlight to be shining here where I am. Now, we could then start talking about all the things that have to have happened in order for the sun to be exploding in the ways that X number of minutes ago gave rise to the sunlight right here now. The point is first to see the non-fixedness, and then to see, and this is the more important point, it's not the theory, is then how do we live this non-fixedness in terms of both so-called our own life, which is never separate, but our own life along with everyone that we encounter. See, so in a sense, and this is the very next paragraph, he says, one of the primary aims of Buddhism is that we experience this fact of ku, of emptiness, or of non-fixed separateness, if I say it that way, ongoing change directly, and this is important, actualize it in our daily life functioning with everyone we have. So he says, to believe Buddha nature, to understand it, to grasp it, not just conceptually, but in our functioning, and to practice or manifest it in order to see it clearly, because you don't see it by concepts, but you see it because your body and your whole being live it, and then it becomes, and then to infuse it into our daily life. That is Buddhism, that is all. See, so, now I want to stop here, because before we finish the rest of this chapter and go on, I want us to really chew on this, and I've talked about this a lot, but I'd like you all to chew on this and come back next week with questions about things. I very much appreciate, Debbie, you're asking these questions, and you're not going to get a complete answer from the words I say. I'll say a little bit, but then and each of us should be saying, and also then you could chew on it and see, what sense does this make to me? What sense does this not make? Or how does this not respond to this aspect of it for me? So I very much appreciate, Debbie, your bringing it up, and I'd like all of you to work on this in that way. So we'll stop here, which is in the middle of page 10. So that's, let's see, it's the second, third paragraph. So next week we'll start with my teacher, that point. But we're not going to start with that if you have points you want to bring up about the earlier part. Okay?
Okay.
So I'd like you all to, you know, just read this and know that this is a particular way of expressing it that was written in the late 60s, early 70s, and therefore there might be better ways of expressing it. There's things in it we could disagree with, and that's great. We should disagree with whatever we want to and then struggle with, well, how does it make sense? How does it not make sense? Okay?
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Good night.
Thank you.
And Lucian.